Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
And me, Ben Hobson.
Today we're speaking with record-breaking ultra-runner Sabrina Virgie about her new book, Where There's a Hill.
It's sort of a play on words, isn't it, Rick? Where there's a will, where there's a hill.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Not to a spoiler, but Sabrina's a brilliant guest, and her incredible attitude to running in life is worth sticking around for.
It's incredibly liberating approach to running. That's for someone who's so incredibly good at it and achieves greatness with it, her approach is that of someone who's fairly indifferent.
It's a bit of a de-stressor for her in her life, and just happens to go around breaking sort of records at the same time.
Yeah.
But yeah, nice to have her on. Hey, look, some other good record-breaking running happened this weekend.
So nice segue.
Ooh, actually, there's quite a lot in there. Hard Rock 100 over in Colorado. That was won by Kilian Jornet and Courtney Darwater, both setting new course records on the clockwise course. I mean, they do clockwise and anti-clockwise.
Anti-clockwise is much harder.
It's insanely difficult either way, I believe. But yeah, Kilian...
Yeah, I honestly don't know what I'm talking about. I was just being flippant.
But yeah, what was Kilian's? 21:36:24 for Kilian and 26:44:36 for Courtney. Yeah. Amazing racing. And then obviously there's been the World Champs, Ben, as well. Been some running going to happen in the US.
I mean, I don't know. People probably saw the UK Athletics sort of like published a statement for Chris Thompson, and he wasn't allowed to race ahead of Eugene World Champs. And it was a visa application was delayed, which was very strange. And the government got involved, and all sorts of sort of, you know, high-powered people couldn't get it to work. But he commentated on the action instead, which, you know, I'm sure was bittersweet for him.
Huge consolation for him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, you know, great to have him doing that.
Yeah.
And it was Ethiopia's Tamarat Tola won with a new championship record of 2:05:37. And he ran the 30 to 40K section in 28:27, Rick.
Can you imagine?
I can't.
Can you imagine? You're sort of like almost end of the, approaching last, 20 miles in.
Last 10K of a marathon, just 28:27. But the women's marathon is being held later today, today being Monday. This comes out on a Tuesday, so we can't, unless we can guess. No, that's no point. We don't know what happened.
That is mad though, isn't it? Like 30K into a marathon, imagine, like you're still with him and then he's like 28:27. I think the 10,000... final was one in 27:30 or something around then. So like it's just amazing. That's why he sort of just blew the field apart, because it was like, right, who's going to live with me running a 28:27 10K?
I mean, just to have
three quarters of the way through a marathon.
The guy should be doing the 10,000 meters. I mean, you know.
Yeah it's crazy, isn't it? It's that kind of injection of speed that you're able
if
to
you can
do
warm is, up for 30K.
Yeah.
And then bang out that time.
Look, maybe it was all about running a negative split, as we've talked about in the show last week.
That wasn't a managed fade or whatever it was called. Ailish McColgan blamed injury in the 10,000 metres after she suffered World Athletics champion disappointment. The 31-year-old expected to have an outside shot of a medal. Having run the second quickest 10,000 metres this year, she finished 10th. Which...
Yeah. You know. Shame that, isn't it? Because he's been running so well.
Yeah. But, you know, injuries. There's not much you can do about that.
Yeah, completely. Yep. Completely.
Unlucky to her.
And then, yeah, another disappointment, I guess, from a British perspective was Dina Ash-Smith finishing fourth in the 100. That was a clean sweep by the Jamaicans. And Shelly-Ann Fraser, who's 35 now, still winning 100 metres. and she runs something like 10:64, I think. And Dina's 10:83 is actually equals her national records, but not good enough for a medal. So that's the sort of era we're living in, yeah.
And that was Shelley-Ann Fraser's prize, fifth World Champs gold.
Wow.
Right?
It's mad, isn't it?
Whoosh.
I think it's just incredibly consistent over the 100 metres, because you say the marathon, say like we sort of are in raptures about Kipchoge's consistency, and he's kind of only lost, I think, two big competitive marathons out of 14 or something. But with the marathon, it's like, of course, there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong in the training, but once you get to the start line, you know, there's time, isn't there, for the best person to emerge. With 100 metres, it's like you get anything like very minor goes wrong in that race, you don't win, because there's just not enough, there's no time to recover. But she's, so to win five world champs is just remarkable, amazing. Other things that are remarkable are, we got a letter in, and it was someone agreeing with me, so I thought I'd bring it out.
So that's why it's made it in. Someone's agreed with you, and you've just...
Someone agreed with me, so whenever anyone agrees with me, I read it out. And that's true in life and away from the podcast as well. Just read it out, just around the desk. But this was the last point about where we were talking about things aren't necessarily more difficult because they're longer. That was the general theme.
But
this is from Christopher, I'm going to say it's either Wagner or Wagner. So sorry, Chris, if I pronounce your name wrong there. He's a runner in Tampa, Florida, US, and enjoys the podcast. And he says, I agree with Rick on the last point. I've been trying to PR my 5K for 15 years now, and I haven't come within 60 seconds of the time I set back then. Meanwhile, I've PR'd the marathon every time I've run it three times, and I believe it would be much easier to PR my next 50K than cracking my best 5K time. So I guess, yeah, someone who's kind of saying, yes, the really intense short stuff can be very difficult, particularly if you set a decent like PB, we would call it here, a few years ago. To get close to it again is going to take a lot of doing, but there you go.
Yeah, 15 years. So, mate, so I don't know how old Christopher is, but let's say he was 20 when he set his 5K PB. As a 35-year-old, is he going to be able to find that youthful speed again?
It's hard to say, isn't it?
Yes, he probably is, but you know, I mean,
it depends how good you were when you were 20, doesn't it? It's one of those things.
Yeah, true. If he was like some sort of, it doesn't say here, but you know, he raced in college or something, and he was actually incredibly fast.
Yeah, and that's tricky, isn't it? If you just like literally like not one out of the park when you're 20, getting back there. Whereas you and I were sort of at uni, probably we probably quicker now.
He's a 15 minute like 5K or something. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Come on, Christopher, we need more details. Please message back. Let us know what your actual times are, because I don't want anyone to actually agree with Rick. So if I can knock this down in any way, I'll absolutely do it.
There was some more talk about... So last week we did these running myths, and one thing that you and I were talking about, Jane was possibly not in agreement with this, but we talked about the control fade and how the positive split strategy is probably best for the amateur, like where you're... First half is fractionally quicker than the second. Yes. A guy called Simon Coombs, a really good masters runner, got in touch and he said that he thought there was a stat from London Marathon a couple of years ago, I believe, where only 3% of people who'd gone under 3 hours had run a negative split. So that's how common a positive split is in marathon. I don't know if the same is true or 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, but I'd imagine it possibly is. And
great stat.
Good stat, isn't it? Yeah, and it shows you that actually, like, you know, I think in the real world, the positive split done responsibly and in a managed way is the way to set most of your
hey,
PBs.
Kids, remember. Yeah. Positive split responsibly. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, none of this, like, you know, it's not about just going out, you know, at an insane speed. We're talking about, like, you know, managed decline, Ben.
Yep.
That's what we're looking at.
I mean, that's all we need in life, Rick, is managing the decline.
Right. Well, I think we should get Sabrina on to talk about her new book.
Yes, so do I. Let's do it.
Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone, could be an athlete, could be a physio, or a complete unknown.
Our guest this week is a record-breaking ultra runner whose new book, Where There's a Hill, details her attempt to set a new standard for the Wainwrights, which involves summiting 214 fells in the Lake District. Sabrina Virgie, welcome back to the Runner's World podcast. So I think it's quite surprising that someone who's obviously gone on to achieve such brilliant things in running you weren't actually a particularly sporty kid. Is that's fair to say, isn't it? It wasn't something that you've been great at your whole life.
Absolutely. I would say I was absolutely the worst in my year. 100%. I was that kid who just couldn't do anything at all. I remember my parents telling me on sports day, they just said, please, could you just not come last in something? Anything, doesn't matter. So I was like third last in the egg and spoon race, and they were like, yeah, well done.
Not last.
There you go.
Mm. Wow.
So when did it suddenly become a thing for you then?
It gradually seeped into my life, shall we say. So my primary school years were all about, oh no, yeah, you're just terrible at sport, even though I was quite keen to do it.
Yeah.
And then up until A-levels, I would say, did I really have a chance to do anything. So I moved to another school for A-levels, and they were very encouraging for me to do whatever I wanted. So I just overindulged. So any sport that I could do, I did do. Team sport, individual. And I wasn't good. You know, I hadn't developed the hand-eye coordination that I should have. Mm. So just found my way then. And then it just developed through university. And I guess I like running. You don't need that many skills for running, actually, you know, compared to ball sports.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I could develop that area. And it was more about persistence, actually. I just keep running. Doesn't matter if you're terrible at it. No one's criticizing. You're on your own. You're not bothering anybody by your ineptitude. I think is probably what it is.
Yeah. There's no teammates and to be disappointed the fact that you have. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So then with the ultra running, I got into that from adventure racing. So I did adventure racing for about 10 years all over the world. And that, I guess, because it was such a niche sport and maybe they were quite desperate for women, because you have to compete as a mixed team to be competitive. So generally it's three guys and one girl.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm just very like, yeah, I'll just do anything with anyone. If someone wants me on their team, I'm there. So it was very inclusive, got involved in that. And I started out, I was quite a strong cyclist, actually. Got huge legs. So I was quite strong on the bike. But then on the running, I was quite weak, actually. And I had never run off road until I did adventure racing. But I really enjoyed it. I really liked the things that you could see and do and the independence it gave me. So I started to concentrate on trying to get better as well, because I felt like I was letting the team down because I was so slow.
Yeah.
I'd even get towed around on a rope just to keep up with the guys. So I was like, well, this isn't good. I'm letting the side down. So I trained a lot more in the running for that. And then I started to find with the endurance as well that I liked that. And I wondered if I started to get stronger on the running then I was actually not the slowest. And I wondered about doing it on my own. And I quite liked when Steve did the Wainwrights, that's when I thought about doing that challenge. And I thought it was very much a sort of adventure racing kind of challenge
because of
the sleep deprivation, having to manage yourself, it's eating and drinking on the move, and making sure your feet don't get blisters and all these things that you need to do in adventure racing was quite transferable to that challenge. And that's where it started, really, my ultra running.
It's an amazing journey, isn't it? Like, to go from third last in egg and spoon to world record or record breaking ultra runner. Was it difficult though to like, because I imagine you would internalize some of that stuff as a kid and think like, oh, I'm not good at sport, or I'm not an athlete because teachers have told me I'm no good at this, or I didn't win at sports day. Did it take you a while to actually take yourself seriously as an athlete, do you think?
I still don't think I'm good. I'm doing something. It pans out okay. I think that's how I live my life. It's just to give it a shot, and if it works, you know. And I guess the lack of expectation, I think, is something as well. I think a lot of people are afraid to fail.
Right.
And I've never had that, because there's been no expectation that I would succeed. There's I might as well just keep trying, and if I just humiliate myself and fail again, I was used to that. And so it's just a kind of unusual thing for me to succeed and do well in something. But I'm certainly not afraid to try. And I think that's really it. I even now, actually, sometimes I say to Ben, I'm gonna try this, and he'll be like, you can't do that. And I'll be like, right.
Right, that's it.
I will or I might, but I'm at least going to try and do that. And yeah.
The fact that you've achieved so much with it now, do you find that there's more pressure? Because if you come into it, as you say, sort of feeling there's no expectation from your side, but you've got everyone else giving, like, putting on expectation onto you. Is that something that you've noticed more and more, or is that just really just not in your sphere of thinking?
Yeah, no, you're right. I remember the first time, I guess, I felt some kind of expectation on me was when I came to do the winter spine in 2020. Because I'd actually won the summer spine outright, there was suddenly this expectation that I was going to win the winter spine outright. And you know, I'd been used to just turning up to these things rather anonymously and just doing my own little thing. And I don't worry about anything and off I go. And whatever happens, happens. And there's no pressure on myself to perform. But then suddenly there were all these people, I was being interviewed, and you know, they were saying, oh yeah, so asking me about, you know, women and men, and of course, you know, now I've shown that women are faster than men. I'm like, oh no.
Oh no.
Oh dear. This is a complete fallacy. It's like, oh dear, what has happened to the world? Right. And that felt a little uncomfortable, but I still sort of said to myself, I can only do what I can do, so never mind what they're expecting, they're going to be disappointed. That's unfortunate. I don't like disappointing people, but it's not like I can change it. So I try not to feel pressure from anyone else, and I think that's probably one reason why adventure racing, when you're racing in a team, there is actually a bit of pressure on you. Or I put pressure on myself because I don't want to let the team down. And that, I think, was probably also one of the motivators to be running on my own, not to have these kind of pressures at all. It was particularly, I didn't mind all the endurance things. I knew I was always capable, but I don't really like, and this seems, I don't know why this shocks people, but I don't really like jumping from height into water. So okay. A lot of people, you know, they'll go to the top of, I don't know, top of something, jump into, you know, water, and maybe I'll manage a meter, and that's about my comfort zone. Okay. It's not very high. Yeah. Probably even less than that. Okay. But we would sometimes need to do 20 meters or something like that. A long distance, I don't know how far, but just too far for me. And that would ruin my whole enjoyment of the race, because I'd panic. At some point, there was going to be a massive cliff jump into water, and I wouldn't be able to do it, and I was going to let the team down. And I'd always find another way round, but it'd probably take a bit longer. And that was the pressure I put on myself, and I didn't enjoy that. But for the running, I don't put any pressure on myself at all.
Yeah, so liberating thing. I think that's a real lesson there for people. With the Wainwrights, then you said it was when Steve Birkenshaw when he did his round. That's when the idea of running 214 of these fells in the Lake District came into your mind. Did it start off as just like a little, was it like just, oh, well, maybe I'll have a go at that one day? Or was it like an obsession from the start?
So this is 2014, and Steve Birkenshaw has basically sent me a Facebook message saying, I'm doing this Wainwright challenge, and may I stay at your bunkhouse? Because it's en route. And I'm like, Steve, of course you can stay at the bunkhouse. And then I'm like, what's this thing? I didn't even know what a Wainwright was. So, you know, that was the whole education itself. And then I was kind of really excited when I started to see what Steve wanted. Oh, he's going to run for like 7 days. That's awesome. Amazing. Well, that looks hard, but yeah, it looks really cool. Bit like adventure racing. I was thinking, oh yeah, he's going to have to, like, in order to beat the time he wants to do, I was thinking to myself, yes, he's not going to sleep very much. He's going to, you know, there won't be any faffing. He'll have to only change his socks once or something. You know, all these things were going through my head, and I was really excited about it. And I was actually really gutted because I wasn't there to help, because I had to work away in Surrey for that whole week. So I was there in Surrey madly dot watching, jealous as hell that I couldn't even, you know, wave Steve on or carry something for him, but my husband got to. And then just watching that, I was like, when he'd done it, I was like, okay, I'm going to try that. It wasn't I might, it was like, I'm going to try that, I'm going to do it, I'm going to see. Yeah, I knew, and in my head, I was like, I'm going to be able to finish that. That's not the question. It's a question of how quickly am I going to be able to do that?
Right.
And he did 6 days and 14 hours or something like that. I thought, well, that's not that far off 6 days. I was like, 6 days is a really good thing. And I didn't know if that was possible. But I just looked at what he'd done. I thought, well, he's had about 40 hours of not running. I thought, well, I can probably whittle that down to maybe something like 10 hours. That gives me 30 hours extra to go slower and get around more of it. And really, that was all it was. And I thought, this is a good challenge for me. This is really exciting. And I was just obsessed. Yeah, that's it. And then, so that was 2014. And I thought to myself, well, how long is it going to take me to learn how to run long distances and be like an ultra runner and do all this stuff? And I thought, okay, well, maybe a few years. And I thought, well, 2020 is a good round year. 2020, let's do it, something big in 2020. That's when I'm going to do the Wainwrights and that. And then that was it. So then the plan.
So good. So
the first few years were just about doing some ultra races. So I did, what did I start with? The Grand Tour of Skiddaw, just because it was conveniently in the Lake District, 44 miles. I thought that's a good distance to start with.
Yeah. Yep.
Really enjoyed it. And then I heard about these UTMB points. So just being me, I was like, well, what else do I need to enter to get more UTMB points? So I did another race. I think it was one of the Endurance Life series. And then it was like, oh, I only need one more race. Oh, it's got to be a 100-mile race. I'll just see what I can do. I've got 2 months left to do one. It's winter, December. Oh, it's going to have to be Poland. okay, that's fine. I've never been to Poland and... 100 miles I haven't run either, but that's fine, that's the race I need to do. So off I went.
Right.
You getting a pattern here?
Yeah, it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, yeah.
And I got my UTMB points and I got an elite start, so I was like, okay. So I did that.
It sounds so matter of fact when you put it like that, but it's such a huge amount of work, but it's just like, oh, well, I better go to Poland then.
Yeah, and I often drag people into it in my mad ideas, because there's not much time to plan to do it. One of my best friends who'd been at school with me, I just said to her, oh, I'm going to go to Poland for the weekend. Do you want to come? She's like, yeah, that sounds good. I don't think I want to run 100 miles, they say. I'm like, no, fair enough. I think she did the shorter race. I can't remember, 30, 40K, something like that. Still decent. And so she came and did that. So we had a great weekend.
So what was your training like before the Wainwrights? How did you sort of prepare? Like, did you look at what Steve had done? Did you look at what other people were doing? Or did you just sort of like use the adventure racing sort of knowledge that you had and what you knew worked for you and just sort of build up to it?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, so as I say, for the first 4 years, I was just learning how to do ultra running, which is going quite well. And then sort of as it got nearer time, I was like, okay, now I really need to do something more specific to get this goal. So that was all about looking at the route and making the route efficient. So I did recces. So rather than a training per se, I'd be like, right, I've got today off. So which part of the route am I going to go investigate? And then, okay, how am I going to go about these particular summits? What did Steve do? Is that the best way around? Okay, his route was really good. I'll do it exactly like that. Or actually, I'm going to try something different. Let's try this. Is it quicker? Is it not? And then I played around with the whole thing over 2 years, just trying this, that, and the other. And that, as it turns out, was really good training. Because I never do training as such, because my running is kind of something I use just to switch off from work and stresses. So I don't want to have pressure to run fast or in a specific way particularly. I just want to go and have a bit of fun in the hills, really. So the recce's were really, really good for that. And it was really interesting because after I'd done the Wainwrights, Rupert from Mountain Fuel, he asked me, it was just really odd, he just sent me a message on Facebook. I think he wanted to write a post about something. And he said, well, in the weeks leading up to the Wainwrights, you know, what were you doing? What was your training? How far did you go? What elevation did you cover? And I said, I thought to myself, I don't know. And then I thought, well, I've got Strava. I can actually look back and tell you exactly what I'd done. And it was really interesting because I was doing about 100 kilometres a week with about 6,000 metres of elevation, I think it was. I think I was doing 200 kilometres and double. That's right. It was 100, for every 6,000 metres of elevation, it was about 100 kilometres of distance. That's what it was.
Okay.
But yeah. And it started about that and probably got towards 200 kilometres. That's right.
Right.
But yeah, it takes, it just takes longer to do rough ground.
Yeah, right.
So you can't get the same kind of distances in. And I think that's a mistake of a lot of ultra runners do that are going to do mountainous stuff. They do too much flat running. And it's fine because you get more bang for your buck. Because if you're running on the flat, you can run hard all the time. Whereas if you're going up in the mountains, you work hard on the way up and not so much on the way down.
I remember when we talked to you last time, I think you'd just done really well at the Dragon's Back race, I think.
Okay.
I think it was Dragon's Back, I suppose. And we talked about like, similar to what you're saying now, that you don't really train, like, it's not like you go and do intervals on a Tuesday, but that you thought maybe your great skills that you just don't give up. Like, I think you gave quite a fun example of, like, you started painting the house one day, and, like, when your husband came back, you were still painting the house. Like, you don't give, like, once you start something, you don't stop something.
Yeah.
And I thought that's really good, because I'd imagine those characteristics are actually really useful for, like, something like the Wainwrights. Do you think that is actually one of your strengths, like you're just like just willful on stuff and you just don't give
in? Yeah, probably one is it's persistence and willfulness, like you say, but the other is probably just distraction maybe. So right. You know, I use the running, it's almost like meditative. So the actual example you're talking about, it was the wallpaper stripping. So it's like once I learned how to do it and I had a technique, that was it, and I just kept going. I didn't even, you know, I hadn't looked at the watch, you know, I just kept going until everything was stripped. And I'm often like that, you know, give me a target or give me a chore and that's it. And I'll do it from start to finish. And if I can't, that's actually quite frustrating.
So did the running as a distraction, did that sort of coincide with the university stuff? Because I remember diligently doing runs every single morning, certainly in final year and building up to exams, like it became such a like part of the routine of just knowing that there was going to be a long day of staring at books and not really understanding what was going on. So I had to go for a run in the morning. Is that sort of part and parcel where that it came from, and that attitude towards it is just being the distraction?
I said I was absolutely mental at university. I don't think I had any idea of planning or discipline or anything like that. Just what happened. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I think I decided that I was going to do running in the morning sometimes. I could not sleep at all at night because I would work till 3 a.m. writing my essays. And then I'd probably go out and have drinks. And then at some point, you know, you'd be in your bed at 6 or something, but then you'd be getting ready to go running. And then you'd go through lectures, and each day you tumbled into the next with was probably very good sleep deprivation training.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds like it. I can relate to that. It wasn't a structured thing. It just sounded very much like the last minute cramming of work, celebrated immediately, and then you get up and try and do some exercise. That was
But now I work and slightly more responsible and disciplined. I do use my running as a distraction, definitely. It's my meditation, it's my stress reliever, it's my freedom, my time, you know, and so I don't have any rules about what I should be doing or how fast I should be going, and so I just put my shoes on and off I go, and I find that very liberating.
With the Wainwright stuff, it wasn't like something that, I mean, I don't want to do anything like spoiler alerts to people, but it took a while, didn't it, to get what you wanted out of it. Was there any point where you thought, like, this is actually beyond what I can do, or I want to go and concentrate on something else now?
this is where I say I got obsessed with it, because I don't know how many people would try to do something and fail and try again and fail and keep going like that. But each time I failed, I went back and was like, well, why did it fail? Was it something I did wrong? Was it something out of my control? What's happened? Right, we'll try and put measures in so that doesn't happen again. And that was kind of like a reiterative process. But yeah, you can still get to the point, you could probably get to a point of fatigue where you're just fed up of not being able to do a certain thing, or you give up.
Sure.
There was no point in my head where I decided that I was going to give up on it. But I was worried that other people would give up on me. So that was the main thing, because you have a support team and it's a lot of planning. Yeah. You know, and in an ideal world, you have one or two people come with you on each leg to help carry the stuff, because that makes a massive difference whether you're carrying a backpack full of water and food or whether you can run without that.
Yeah, right.
So I wanted to, so in order to do the best time I could do, I wanted a team like that. So it was a huge amount of planning on my part to form a spreadsheet so that I had someone every place and some road support so that those runners could get picked up and you know, Ben could be there with our camper van, ideally, so I could sleep in it. And we didn't have the camper van for the first and second attempts, and it made a huge difference there. I was most worried about people not wanting to help, because they were like, well, yeah, she's just not going to get round. But I was really encouraged by all my friends who knew I could do it and so wanted to be there and very much wanted to be involved. And also some other new people who'd just seen me do it the other times and thought, oh, no, that's so unfortunate that you didn't get it that time. They want to come and help. So, yeah.
Yeah, running's good like that, isn't it? It's a good supportive community, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've now got a book.
I know. How did that happen?
How did that happen?
How did that happen? I know. Bit like my running, really. I've actually always wanted to write a book. That is definitely true. And I think it's one thing, probably my mum might have quite encouraged me down that route as well. Because when I was younger, I used to write little stories as a child, little children's stories. And I think the teachers quite enjoyed reading them, and my mum quite enjoyed reading them. My mum, in fact, once found my diary of my tales of travels to Mongolia and other places. And she read it cover to cover because she thought it was meant for her.
Right.
But anyway, sure. She found it extremely entertaining. She said the way I wrote, she found it very easy to read. In fact, she couldn't put it down. So right. I think from then, I just quite like writing. I've always liked writing. And just from being a vet, I've never, you know, I just hadn't gone down that route of busy being a vet. So it was really pleasurable to be approached by a few publishers to ask me to write about the Wainwrights. And I thought, that's really cool. I will do that. And I thought I needed that support, I think, to write something from start to finish, because I have actually started writing books, veterinary ones, just anecdotes of funny things that happen as a vet, because it's just too funny. Yeah. Your day-to-day experience. And I could go on forever about veterinary stories, and one day I might write a veterinary book. But so having someone who wanted to read about my Wainwrights, my running, about me, stuff like that, I thought, right, someone wants this, I'm going to write it. And just like everything, you know, I just got on with it and just did it. And, you know, my creative moments, my writing time tends to be at between midnight and 3 a.m. roughly. Oh, so
just like university. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when I can focus really well and intensely and get a lot of content out. And so that stuff was the stuff that came out of flowed quite well. And then, you know, you get a whole bunch of this. So I do this, you know, various nights when I felt like it, should we say. I never forced myself, a bit like my running. I never forced myself to write it. It was just like when something was ready to come out, it got put on the page. And I had a collection of all this stuff. And you kind of want to organize it. And then I was like, there were missing bits that needed to tie things together. And those are the bits I'd try and sit down in the daytime when I was actually thinking a bit more strategically and write down in a sort of more appropriate manner, or should I say, organized manner. And then I'd be like, but those are really boring. I was like, no one wants that. And so they'd just get scrapped. And So I had quite a few drafts. So I did the first draft quite quickly, probably a couple of months. Right. And then did a second draft, third draft, fourth draft. And then finally I found I had something that I thought was good and ready. Mm. I passed that on to the publishers. And then they gave me some feedback, and then we did a bit more work. And it's just really interesting process, actually, this book writing thing. You know, I had no idea the time frame or what was involved. And then I thought we were all done and dusted. You know, here we go, here's the book. Brilliant. Yeah. You've read it. Oh, no, now it's going to go to a proper editor. I'm like, oh, okay. Oh. And then, yeah, and then that restructured it a little bit more into chapters, actually. You know, people like chapters. I hadn't put it into chapters because, right. you know, it's far too boring, isn't it? But no, the chapters actually, really work. So, you know, an editor's got a skill there. And I worked with Ed Douglas and you know, I was so impressed with what he could do. Really, it was really insightful, this whole thing. I've really enjoyed it. The way you can run from one thing, leave it on a cliffhanger and then boom, boom, what's happening in the next chapter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really fun experience, I have to say.
Did you find it kind of interesting to relive the whole experience in that way of writing it down? Because you can put, you know, in the different attempts, you probably thought about how you'd done the previous one before, or you'd sort of like made notes at the time or something, but to actually sort of go through and write it all down as if, it was going to become a book. Did it sort of like unpick a lot of it for you?
Yeah, and I'd remember things that I'd forgotten about. Mm. And actually, I think it'll be really interesting when other people, when my support team read it, and there'll be bits that I've completely not put in or I remembered it really differently because obviously you've got to remember I'm pretty sleep deprived.
And
Ben's read it, obviously, and he's just like, Sabs, that's not true.
That was hallucination. Unreliable recollections from an ultra marathon.
I've done my best because I wanted it to be as it happened. And I used some things. Actually, it's interesting because a lot of communication now we do, you know, using Messenger on Facebook. Mm. So actually, I had a lot of the conversations from before the event, you know, all the stuff around organising it. And that's been really helpful because it would, A, rejig my mind, but also make sure that when I was quoting somebody, I was actually quoting somebody. Right. So that was really good because I didn't want to ever put something in there, you know, this person said this when they actually didn't. So that's all been really good. So,
to anyone else who was thinking about taking on a challenge, it doesn't have to be the Wainwrights. It could be anything that seems daunting. What would your advice be?
I guess you've got to have a vision of how you want to achieve something. I think it's really important when you're setting your goals that they should be appropriate to yourself. So I don't try to set myself a goal that's completely impossible for me to ever achieve, because that would just be really frustrating. But equally, you don't want a goal that is so easily achievable, because what's the point? I mean, that's not very satisfying. Yeah. So goal setting is really the first stage, I think, when you set yourself a challenge, is make sure that it's an appropriate thing for you to achieve. So it should have an element of failure. Like, if you don't think it's possible for you to fail, what's the point? You've got to put yourself out there. You've got to challenge yourself. There must be this element of failure. Once you've set yourself the correct target, then you need to figure out how you're going to set about achieving it. I guess break it up into the elements of what it is. For me, the Wainwrights was, okay, well, it's really important to get the route right, because if I'm going further than I need to, then, you know, that's already a setback. Yeah. So I wanted to investigate the route. Obviously, I needed to be physically fit. How fit? Well, you can always be fitter, can't you? But there's no point being sprint fit. This was going to be a long thing. So actually, a lot of walking probably quite useful. Yeah. Hill walking. I needed to do hills. There's no point, again, training on the flat if you're just going to have a hilly challenge. And then all the other elements around it. So, you know, how was I going to eat? What was I going to wear? What equipment did I need? What about head torches? What was I going to drink? How often was I going to need these things? And all these things you learn from the process of the recces, really. So I could tell how long the section would take, roughly what I was going to eat, how much I needed to drink. You know, and going out in all sorts of weathers to get used to, you know, what clothes work and, you know, how long does my head torch battery last? How many torch, you know, how many batteries am I going to need? All that sort of thing. So you need to practice a lot. You know, if you're preparing for, say, Lakeland 50 or something, you know, you're going to go and recce the route. And then, you know, you're running at night. So you need to have a head torch that works for you, that you can see what you're doing. And that's going to last the correct amount of time. So equipment's really important, and learning how to use it. No point having a head torch that's going to need a battery changed, and you can't do it in the dark.
Yeah, sleep deprived.
Yeah, been there. Yeah.
How can people get hold of Where There's a Hill, your book?
So Vertebrate Publishing. It's on their page.
When is it pre-release?
It's ready for pre-order now.
Right.
And then September is when it will actually be published. Which I'm a bit impatient. I think that's a long time to wait, but
yeah.
Hey, there's nothing to do about it.
People can do some running in the meantime, can't they? In preparation. Thanks so much for your time and coming on the Runners World podcast. It's so inspiring talking with you, actually. It makes me think, I need to start setting myself a few more lofty goals, because you make it all sound so achievable, actually, which is which maybe it is. Maybe it's more achievable than people think, actually. So I think that's it's a really nice message and very liberating.
Yeah, definitely. I think people should be reaching for things that they don't think they can do, and they can surprise themselves. And you know, if you try something and fail, you know, why didn't that work? What do you need to do to make it work? It's a very rewarding process, and I think builds character and helps you in everyday life, I would say.
Thanks again for your time. Thanks for coming on. It'd be great to get you back on at some point, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So that brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. Thanks very much to our guest, Sabrina Virgi, and to you, of course, for listening.
You can subscribe to 3 issues of Runner's World for just £5. Head over to hearstmagazines.co.uk/runnersworldpodcast to get this exclusive listener offer. You are already listening to the Runner's World podcast, so thank you so much indeed. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do. That means you just won't miss a single atom of fantastic podcasting that we deliver. You can tell your friends all about it, share a link on Instagram, maybe just do it that way. That's a good way to do it. Just search Runner's World UK on your favorite podcast apps, whichever way you want to do it. Just get the message out there. This is the place to be for this sort of level of running chat. Thanks again for listening, and you'll hear from us next week. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love, and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.